friends to Tanked Up, the podcast all about video games and craft beer. I'm one of your hosts, Ben, here with the deal.
Hey!
Hey, it's episode 461. Let's open some beers, let's talk about some games and various things. What are you going to drink this evening?
Excuse me. I'm going to have the Brass Castle Brewery's Bad Kitty Vanilla Porter.
Nice.
Fancy little looking disco ball rhinestone-y type tin. We've got 5.5% robust dark porter enhanced with vanilla, gluten-free, and no lactose, hence why I bought it. It is, in fact, badged with vegan-friendly.
Nice.
I haven't had a lot from Brass Castle. I can't remember what was the last thing I had from them, so I have no... At least in my conscious brain, I have no, like, expectations. I have no idea what this is. It just looks fun and cool. It is ruby red on the pour, which I'll save all my other comments.
Nice.
For after you tell me about your beer.
Cool. Well, I'm going for Wiper and True's Kaleidoscope Twist. Ooh. So this is a 5% fruited pale ale, but as you'll see on the flavor text and on the can, Kaleidoscope is 10 years old, and they brought out a couple of slightly different versions of Kaleidoscope. I drank, I think it's called Kaleidoscope Bright earlier, which is about 4.5% lager, which was nice. But I thought I'd save the fruited pale for the podcast. But brewed to celebrate 10 years of our flagship beer, this fruited adaptation takes all the things you love about Kaleidoscope and dials up the sunshine, exploding with bright citrus and vibrant tropical fruit flavors. This hazy number has a juicy mango twist that will leave you wanting more. A familiar favorite through a different lens. Store and serve chilled. Cool. Kaleidoscope with a bit of mango in. Yeah.
Sounds good.
And I don't know, because the lager was a little bit lighter. I think it was about 4.4, maybe, something like that. I can't remember exactly what Kaleidoscope is percentage-wise, but yeah, this one's a 5. So whether that changed because they've added some fruit, who knows?
Yeah.
I do not, but I will pour it as we round back to the Brass Castle.
Yeah, so on the pour, it actually... Except for the red tinge, it like poured. It's thin enough in on the pour and like visually. Sorry, my brain isn't working great because yesterday was the last day of term, I spent the entire day doing nothing and decompressing and realizing how much decompressing I needed. Like I have some like cleaning etc. to do, and I was like, nope, I'm writing this day off. I'm just gonna. And it was great. What a great day. Turns out rest, as a human animal, is important. That everyone tells you, but this was one of those moments where it's like, yes, I can feel the difference.
good.
Anyway, on the pour, yeah, it's got this like, it really reminded me of pouring a cola.
Okay.
Except for that red tinge. And if you look at this, it kind of looks like one as well. Like it didn't generate a ton of head. It's still, you probably can't tell on camera, but it just has that, like, the right, slightly less opaque, the opacity just reminded me on the pour and even in front of me of like, a cola soft drink, which is interesting. On the nose, I get that vanilla immediately. I get the porter, I think the red might be giving me like thoughts of cherry that might not be on the nose, but just how brains work. But yeah, it just smells like a porter. Okay, I immediately feel that vanilla. Oh, yeah, it continues. Interesting. So it's got the right like. It's 5.5%, but I would say even on the taste, it's a light porter in the sense that like, nothing's in your face. It's quite subdued tastes. It does have a really nice almost burnt dark beer taste to it. but it's immediately offset by that sweetness that the vanilla is adding.
Yep.
On these first two quaffs, it's feels a bit too sweet. Okay. And I think that's just the vanilla, like, kind of masking some of the, like, more boisterous portery tastes. I'm hoping my palate will acclimatize around that, because, like, that first sip actually felt like, oh, I don't like this. Like, it's a little too, the vanilla is doing too much work. But even on the second sip, that's, like, already tempered back, and that's in the first, like, 30 seconds of, like, actually having the beer. Let me have another sip, actually. Yeah, so I'll say you get just enough sweetness from the alcohol. You get lovely porter notes, a little bit of red berry. And again, I think what's selling it for me is the slightly, like, the, and again, the, this is under the framing of most of this is very light and, like, nuanced, not in your face flavor, but there is that slightly burnt acrid portery taste that is giving me, like, it's just enough to, like, make me go, okay, so the vanilla is not, like, gonna be overpowering. It's really tasty. My one worry is that I can easily drink this really quickly, because it's just such a laid-back taste, and the thing, I feel myself searching for that porter kind of through the vanilla, and because it's just a small window in the overall taste profile where that becomes, like, super apparent, and the fact that it drinks really easily makes me think that I'll be, like, subconsciously, like, quaffing often just to, like, oh, yeah, that's the part of the taste I want. And it's not to say the other parts of the taste aren't good, but that's, like, the thing that's drawing me to it, and it's unfortunately a small window in the, like, inoffensive first sip vanilla wave pocket of, ah, yes, this is a dark beer. And then when that fades, you're left with, I'm left with kind of a neutral mouthfeel and taste at the end, which is not bad. It's just, I mean, this is what you get when you get a vanilla porter, right? You're not sure how portery it is. I have my personal tastes. Again, I don't think this is bad. I really want that porteriness to just hit me a little harder and make it confirm that this is a porter rather than this is an easily drinkable beer. Mm-hmm. And it's very possible that the brewers were looking for an easily drinkable beer, and I was just hoping for a thing that doesn't line up with that. But, like, that's where I'm at with this.
Yeah, I think Bad Kitty, or at least from the can art as well, I think that's one of Brass Castle's core range. It's one of their sort of, you know, the dots, I think, varying colors on their core range of beers. I haven't had anything from them for a little while. Yeah,
we don't get them often up here.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had Bad Kitty.
Yeah.
I mean, this would make more one-offs from them.
This would make sense. I also say that I've had a few beers to the Hop Knocker before I got here, so that might be influencing the fact that I had bigger ABV, wider taste profile beers.
Yep,
that's one of the reasons why, like, I had a couple beers to choose from today. I'm like, porter, that should be fine when I've just had a stronger-ish beer, and that might have been a miscalculation. But by the end of this, I'll have a very good idea of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your Kaleidoscope was what was the percentage?
So it's 5.
Yeah, so I think the OG is 4.2-ish.
Let's have a glance. Try and find it. Actually, I should have looked at that.
I conveniently did. That's not a one up. I had the moment to look it up. And 4.2, like, is what the current one is. But also, that's what my memory was. Like, I'm pretty sure it was like 4 something. Right. And then the current Kaleidoscope range is at 4.2.
Okay.
So I suspect that's, like, their standard ish.
Yeah. They've lifted this one up slightly then. But it's nice. I mean, it does have a big mango nose, as you can see. It pours
quite that's a good orange.
Clear. It's very orange.
I can see your thumb. Thumb that's on the back. Glass through it, even with the webcam, etc.
And the head poured as I dissipated as I was pouring as well. It's disappeared quite quickly off of the glass. But lovely big mango nose. Very, very sweet. almost like the way that you sort of smell it, that little bit of sweetness almost makes it feel like it's going to be a little bit chewy. But I don't imagine it will be. But it's got that little bit of mango, but with a hint of like caramel or toffee. It's that kind of level of sweetness that it's got on the nose.
So I will say that they also have the Bright out, which is so also 4.2%, but it's brilliantly clear and refreshingly lager adaptation.
Yeah, so that's the lager I had about an hour ago. Yeah. Which is nice as well. So, very nice.
Yeah. I like that this is interesting because we've talked a lot about how Wiper and True have their stable offering, but we can tell that they are tweaking the recipe constantly in a way that which is like very craft beer, but isn't like fully in line with this is our stable line and why we like that. And so it's interesting that they are doing these riffs. So they've got a pale ale that of the Bright that is like advertised as more lager-esque because it's they're focusing on clarity and like clean drinking, and then they've got this mango infused twist to be hazy. But like the fact that they said it's a 10th anniversary hazy ale, and like it's not that hazy, but I guess it's because they've released both of these, and like in contrast with the Bright, presumably this is hazy.
I would say in contrast, absolutely. Yeah.
But like if I looked at Wiper, if my memory of Wiper and True and all the Wiper I've had, I wouldn't call that hazy at all. Like even in their line and over the years, because like I could see your thumb through the thing, and they have had hazies that are hazy.
Yeah, it's almost like satin. Satin tinted glass or obscured kind of glass, rather than it being sort of a hazy sort of coloring to it.
It's got like mild translucence, right?
Absolutely.
Versus like a proper hazy ale has barely translucence, is how I would describe it. It's like might not be fully opaque, but boy, is it close. And this is like so much closer to translucent.
Absolutely. And I wonder if that comes from the carbonation. Don't get much of the carbonation on the beer at all. Mm. And again, I've just poured the rest in and no head whatsoever from the can. But it's a lovely flavor. It's very, very light in its body. It's not thin, but it's got this kind of slight body to it. Not much, but it's slightly thicker than the lager was. Just a touch more. But that flavour is very, very nice because you are presented with that mango. It definitely is the big, bold flavour within the beer. But it does have that sweetness in here, which I don't know. There's something, I don't know what it is. There's something almost like toffee esque about it. I can't quite put my finger on what that combination of flavors is to make it like that. I'm getting a lot of citrus, I'm getting some orange, I'm getting a little bit of lime in there as well, and that's really zesty. It's almost like it's lime peel rather than lime juice as well, which is really nice because it kind of cuts through the sweetness of the mango and the other fruits that are coming into this. So you get hit by that fruitiness, but it just zings it a little bit with that really zesty citrus in there as well. And you're left with an overriding flavor of a slightly dulled down mango, slightly dulled down sort of tropical fruits with that citrus cutting straight through it. It's really dry. So I think I would reach for this more because it's drying me out than I would do for refreshing the flavor. Because it's got a lovely long-lasting flavor,
but just to it, the drying pushes you to drink faster than the finish actually fades.
Absolutely, and it is nice when you refresh because you get that hit of sweetness, and then the zest kicks in, that citrus kicks through, and that just sits nicely. It kind of, you know, you're hit with this big fruit. And the citrus pulls it down, leaves it at a lovely level where it's balanced nicely with the rest of the citrus flavors. This is a lovely beer. This would be a beautiful beer on a lovely warm sunny day, as it has been here, at least in Bristol today, this would be lovely to sit in the pub with, in the garden, in the sun. And, you know, we're getting into that season. The sun is coming out more. So perhaps it's, yes, 10 years. But let's make, rather than, you know, they've done Collide Dipper and a few other takes on Kaleidoscope, haven't they, over the years? So bringing in a couple of, well, one light lager and one sort of fruited pale makes sense, like leading into the summer. Give us some nice, like, refreshing beers to run with. So, yeah, this is really good. And I'll continue drinking it as we shift our focus onto video games. I have, whilst you were talking about Brass Castle,
yeah,
for some reason, in my brain, I'm like, oh, I remember a beer from them. It wasn't a beer from them at all. It was a beer from Burnt Mill. So I'm just looking at their, just looking at their beers now. I'll look at that later. We'll talk about some games. I know you've got a talking point, but maybe I'll just kick off with a quick game that I have been playing. In addition to all of the other things that I've continuously been playing, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about Marathon later. But I've been playing a smaller game on PC called Packing Life. And this is a, it's a lovely, cozy little game. It's by a studio called Oroco Game Studio. I've not heard of them before, but they have made a couple of games in the last two years, actually. 2024, looks like that was their first game, which is on Steam. But Packing Life is a, almost, it's a puzzle game, right? But it's a bit of an inventory management type game. So you are a new worker in a packing facility, and you in a lovely big plastic tub, you have a bunch of shadowy items within there, and you have to take the items out of that tub and pack them into a cardboard box. And then,
so you work for Amazon?
Ship, that, yeah, almost, almost. And it does seem like it is more like Amazon, because there's quite a wide variety of items. So they're more Temu, probably. But you, or what was the one before Temu? Wish. Maybe it's Wish.
Yeah. I forgot Wish was a thing.
I think Wish is probably just Temu now, right? More than likely, just changed the name. But it presents all of this in a nice little narrative package. You get this nice little sort of chat between the girl that you are and then the person employing her, as two sort of almost like they're standing in the doorway and the sun's, you know, coming in through the doorway, because you just see their shadows on the floor,
like silhouette.
It's silhouettes, absolutely, just in front of the packing station. And it's, I think, it's a very relaxing game. So you've got two modes, one which is timed and one is untimed. And
that could actually be a secret commentary on Amazon.
Well, you know, potentially. I have only played on untimed, because I'm like, I don't
want to. Why would you want to choose that? Like, that's actually what he means with the secret commentary. It's exactly like, oh, right. Yeah, this is like a slight dig. It's like, who the fuck would choose the thing absolutely that happens in the real world?
Yep. And it's, so it presents the game to you by saying you are working a 9-till-5 shift, and you've got to pack 8 parcels. Cool, I will crack on. On the timed version, obviously there is a I don't know what the timer is and how quickly that relates to real sort of minutes. But there'll be penalties because you're earning money at the end of each day, and so there'll be penalties for not packing, sort of things. But
presumably, when it's on, finding a bottle to pee in because you're not having a bathroom break.
No breaks. Just for the work 9-to-5 straight through. No lunch or anything. Or they do like 1-to-5 or morning shifts, those kinds of things. But it progressively gets that bit harder. So, you know, on day 4 or 5, you might be doing a shorter shift, you know, a 4-hour shift, but you've still got to pack 8 boxes. So there is a bit of...
Even with the untimed, there actually is a time.
So there's no time. On the untimed one, you just do it at your own pace. You can get through all 8 of those boxes and get them shipped. Right. There's no countdown or anything like that.
So is there like a pass mechanic, or is it always just like you will get 8 puzzles?
So it's not, no, it's not always, it's not always 8. So, you know, like day one might have been, I don't know, 8 puzzles across that larger shift. Day two was maybe 4 across the shorter shift, then 6 across, but bigger boxes. And so there's 3 different box sizes going from small, medium to very large. And you might get 5 items you've got to pack. You might get 10 items you've got to pack. You might get 10 very small items you've got to pack versus like 6 big items.
Right, but the untimed is essentially you just get n number of boxes.
Yes, you get, it's this shift. There's 8 boxes in the shift. You've got to pack 8 boxes at your own pace. Cool.
Right.
In the timed version, it would be you've got to pack these 8 boxes within the time frame that we've set for you for this shift. Sort of thing.
Right. Sorry, this is probably my like logic brain going where it's like, oh, there's actually 2 different timers going. One is a shift needs to absolve or resolve n boxes, which where n might fluctuate, and but the like time version is to you have a actual real world timer to do that.
I would think so, yes. As I said, I've not done the timed version, but like, I would think absolutely there is a real world timer.
Do you start your shift with knowing how many boxes are to come?
Yes. So it shows you that in the bottom left, which is also, at the moment, there's just an infinity symbol when I'm playing. But I would imagine that is where the timer would be kind of counting down.
Right, but like your shift, you start your shift and then you're told N boxes.
I think it might, when you start your shift, before you start the shift, a screen comes up, which I think tells you how many boxes you're meant to pack that shift. But what I like is that there is a procedure in place. So it's not just put things in the box. There are a few variables in this. So if you've put too many things, the box is just a little bit too big. You've got to put packing paper in to protect stuff. There is liquid. So you're shipping bottles of water or cans. So you've got to put different, and then there's fragile elements. So you've got to put different stamps on the box depending on what's going in. You've got to print the label. You've got to scan every item that kind of comes through before you put it in the box. And the real puzzle is that each of the boxes is a certain amount of squares.
Mm-hmm.
And that is width and length, but also height as well. So you are packing kind of in 3D, and you are able to layer things on top of each other. You're able to manipulate and turn items on that 3D plane. So you can kind of pack things in either as you're picking them out of this shadowy box, because you don't know what you're going to pick out. So you don't get to look at the things you have to put in first and then organize them in. You pick one thing out and go, okay, it's this thing. I'll put it in the box. You pick the next thing out and go, oh, I've got this massive thing that's going to take up the entire bottom of the box, but it's only one, you know, square high. So that needs to either sit on the bottom or sit on the top. So you have a storage, a small area on the bench. You could put it to the side and then rearrange everything.
I mean, this does sound like an indictment of Amazon, because that sounds like exactly the bad design that they would do. Because obviously what you should do is get... And I see all 8 things and then fucking be able to start, like, plan beforehand. So is it literally, like, do you get an item count and then you get revealed the items one by one?
No, you don't even get an item count. You just have the box on the left. You hover over, grab, and pull it out, and it will just pull whatever the item is. And
so, like, you could just get a completely, like, shitty, like, revelation of the things and have to constantly take things out to put them in the storage bay to put them back in?
Yes. I think that's my
That's
only... it,
shitty.
it is, but I think it's kind of the... It's part of the puzzle. The part of the puzzle for the timing mechanic, right? If you knew everything, it's that little bit easier of going, oh, I can see exactly how all of this would be arranged.
Yeah.
That slight element of surprise of pulling random stuff out of the box to pack in. They're always, in a way, the box is kind of themed. So you might pick out a 4x3x4 pack of coffee beans. Jeez. And you go, okay, well... I'm more than likely going to get another pack of coffee beans at some point. I might get a French press. I might get this. And I might
I see.
They're themed a little bit in a way. You know, you pull out a little tub of pencils and go, oh, it's stationery. I might now get the like 8x4 pack of A4 paper. So I think I need to maybe, obviously you only know that once you've gone through a few rounds and you've discovered what these sort of levels of theming are.
There's like a standardization of there's like a enough of a limitation on potential products that you can learn things, and because they're themed, you can So they, like the gameplay mechanic is like odds are this is going to be entirely stationary stuff. What do I currently know about potential stationary stuff? If I wanted to save time, I will tuck this in a corner or I'll rotate this, etc., and then there might be a curveball where that's not, that thing didn't appear, but like, you know, kind of in this theme, things are roughly this size range.
Absolutely. So I might, and I'll show the can, for example, but you get something that's full of pencils that is, you know, if it's stood up, the base is only a 4x4 square, two by two square, but it's like, eight high. Right. So you know that actually if I stand that up in the corner, I'm not taking up that kind of bottom space to be able to put bigger things in. So I've got another one. Great. I'll stand it next to it. Oh, now I've got a sellotape dispenser, which is like that shaped if I stand it up. But actually, I can stand it up this way. So I can just put that in and put that next to them as well. So you get to start to recognize those patterns of kind of what you've got coming in. And there's a little bit of limitation on it. So one of the items I've had is a pair of boots. That is not a, you're not able to pack the negative space, say, on the top of the boot. The boots are a cube, and that is what you have to put into the box. So
boot
you don't,
box, presumably.
No, it's not even a box. It's just two boots, and you put the two boots in as one item. But the negative, you know, you're not putting an L shape within that to pack that negative space. It is just a cube, which is two boots that you're putting in. So
can you put stuff on top of the cube?
You could put stuff on top of the cube if the box was deep enough. Yes, you could put stuff on top of the cube, but you could put stuff on top of the negative space of the cube and it would just hover above the negative space.
Right. Yeah,
so there are limitations and they're only working in cubes or rectangles. Even when you're putting in, so I pulled out some plates, so circular.
Yeah.
And there was maybe two plates on top of each other. So really not a tall item, but very wide and very long kind of item to put in. But again, it just you can't then use the corner cells within the box to place other things in.
Right.
I'm not like, oh,
so
cool.
This is everything has a rigid, rounded up hitbox.
Absolutely.
If we wanted to be so, like...
Yes, so there is a slight limitation
about it.
On it, and it's when you're and again when you're putting packing paper in, you I think only have to hit the game decides how many you have to put in, and once you've put that many in, it's done. It doesn't matter where you put them. So again, there's no like level of understanding physics of how things might move within the box whilst it's being shipped. It is just put thing in box and that is done.
Because these things are essentially graphics that have like transparency but are full hitboxes.
Yes, yeah,
and
then, absolutely.
And presumably it's like, these things have a fragility score, so you need to put packing tape or packing materials to satisfy the overall like the gestalt fragility index, and then it doesn't actually matter that like these things wouldn't move in this way it's not a physics simulator.
It's not a physics simulator, absolutely not. They've definitely lent much more into the kind of relaxing vibe of it, especially with the no timer kind of mode. You know, you can just go, I just want to put some things into boxes, see how my inventory management on a 3D sort of level is.
This is like 3D Resi 4, right?
It is. It is a little bit.
It's just as soon as you said that it was these like full container like thing interpretation of things, where it's just things are just in the box. They take up the box or they don't take up the box. Although it does have this like fragility, or like the need for packing stuff is interesting. But like
Yeah.
it, from a like gaming standpoint, these could be read as like idealizations that like take away from the uniqueness of the thing that it's pretending to replicate. But especially if you're playing this as a cozy game, these sound like exactly the right types of rounding errors. But like, I'd be super curious about people who play it in the timed version, whether these like abstractions from the actual geometry and physics of the things would make you more annoyed because you are under time pressure, or whether like actually it's fine because once you're on time pressure, you're too busy thinking about these things as cubes, because that's how like a human's brain, right? Like it's like I don't care that this is a plate. I care that it's a 2x3x1 object.
Object, absolutely, absolutely. And I think whether it is that level of, whether it's playtested in a way and they go, it needs to be this level of simplicity to the items that you're putting in. Otherwise, it just becomes too stressful. You just chuck stuff in the box otherwise. And to make it too real, I think would pull away from that kind of relaxing vibe that it has to it. But it is fun. It's a fun sort of like, I'm going to spend 10, 15 minutes. Just do a shift, pack some boxes, and then go back to what I was doing kind of before without having to get too intense with any of it, which at the moment is fantastic when the other games that I'm playing are just intense, fucking heart palpitating fests, ultimately.
The real games,
Real
according to shitty
games
gamers,
for the
right?
real
Like,
men. Yes.
yeah.
Yeah. But we'll talk about that in a moment. Let's jump on to the thing that you want to chat about this
Yeah.
evening.
So, I'm very dumb. So I'm rocking two monitors right now, but I'm on my laptop because we've talked about this before. So I did the classic, like control tab switch. Thanks, because I'm looking at the browser on this monitor, forgetting that like obviously the last thing I clicked was on this one. So I like I'm glad I'm not recording, because I like wiped us away for a bit because Discord's like, you want to look at this window? I'm like, no. But yeah, the thing I want to talk about was DLSS 5.
Oh,
I don't know
okay.
if you've bumped into this particular thing. So Nvidia releases their DLSS 5, and I mean, I have had a slight problem with what DLSS is, and like the so like frame gen. This is what this is. It's frame generation, and I've been skeptical about the technology from the get, because it's essentially using machine learning and the VRAM available on graphics cards to generate frames that aren't generated from the graphics engine, the game engine, to fill in frames such that you can have a higher frame rate. And there's a bunch of like people really like it because number go up, but also like there it is smoother on like lower powered machines or whatever. But ultimately these frames aren't generated by the constraints of the engine, and people since the very beginning have been like, oh yeah, it gets kind of weird sometimes because it generates things like, and like the early DLSS, I don't want to go into like a huge history of DLSS, but the early DLSS, essentially the problem of that was, and most of the subsequent generations up until now, is they're getting the graphics buffer from the game engine feeding the graphics card. The graphics card sees a flat image because the game engine has all kinds of physics and modeling and 3D shit. And it's interpolating, it's predicting based on the flat image what the next flat image might look like, but obviously depth and things aren't built into that thing. It's not an engine in of itself, etc. And so you can get, because of the training data on similar games, etc., you can get like really good interpolation, but then you get these weird artifacts because like basic things like depth don't exist. That's DLSS up until now. A lot of it turns out people were up in arms in the beginning, and then they kind of got used to it because the engines were tweaked to be less aggressive, because all this interpolation, again, is on just the 2D image that is fed to your graphics card to display, not the fucking programmed world and its moving parts, right?
Yep.
So DLSS 5 comes out, and hopefully you'll understand why I brought all this up. But like, essentially, DLSS 5, NVIDIA has this event, and they clearly think everyone's really wowed by this. And it essentially, like, they are giving photorealism on top of games. Mm-hmm. And I think the best example of this is the brand new Resident Evil, where, oh, what's her name? The main character who's not Leon.
The name's escaped me.
But she's like down on her luck. Like thematically, she's down on her luck. Things suck. She's like a mousy FBI agent who works in an office and suddenly finds herself in like a fucking hospital full of zombies. Mm-hmm. That's like the first move of this game. And so her original, like, if you haven't seen this, listeners and viewers, go just look up the side-by-sides that NVIDIA put up. She's like got no makeup. Her hair's kind of like a little more messed up than you might think. Like, she's like clearly in this place in life. This is obviously a well thought out visual representation of the character. And then NVIDIA, in their showcase, they're like, look at this brand new game. Look what we can do. And it fucking AI filters her up such that her hair has less frizzy things. She's got makeup on, her pores are less clear, and that's only one of the many things where they're essentially like filtering AI, photorealistic AI filtering up all of the things. And like, obviously, a random elf in like Skyrim game or whatever it was looks better, but he was like a flat design from an older game, and it didn't change the nuance of the character, but also there wasn't... What would it mean to change the nuance of a much more sidelined character?
Yeah, yeah.
There was huge backlash, thankfully, because this is insane. Like, you are changing the direction. Why I wanted to bring this up was, one, like, we shouldn't expect any more from... If you haven't already learned or still disagree with me if you have heard my opinions on these things. But like, these things can't enhance to in the direction of what the like artistic decisions are. They can only enhance towards the average of the things that they were trained on.
Yeah.
Right? That's just, this isn't like tinfoil hat. That's like how the technology works.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so obviously it's giving makeup to a blonde woman because it's trained on a bunch of the internet. And like, if anything, I think one of the things that sucks about the reporting on this is it's not commenting on why would it have done that? Oh, right. We've got a misogynist internet. Anyway, that's probably me going more far away than I need to. But why I want to bring this up is because our boy Jensen, CEO of NVIDIA, responded, and he responded with, like, we created the technology, we didn't create the art. And then he followed up with, when people were saying DLSS 5 creates worse homogenous imagery or imposes NVIDIA's view on things work, he says, first of all, they're completely wrong. As I explained very carefully, DLSS 5 infuses controllability of geometry and textures and everything about the game with generative AI. DLSS 5 is great because it's geometry controlled, but it's conditioned by the ground truth of the game. It enhances and adds generative capability to it, but doesn't change the artistic control. It's not post-processing at the frame level. It's generative control at the geometry level. So that's the quote I wanted to like bring this up on, because there's like, again, this is one of those things where I could go off for an hour dissecting this, but like, there's like a very obvious thing, which is no one cares where it's interfering, you idiot. They're saying this interference doesn't work.
Yep.
And so you saying they're completely wrong because people are saying it's a generative AI filter is at best technically correct, but misses the point by so many miles. It's like, so his claim is DLSS 5 isn't just doing the 2D filtering thing. It's actually tied into the geometry, like the it interfaces at the geometry level, so it can actually interpolate on the basic geometries of the the engine or something. He also, at another point, said, this is very different from generative AI. It's content-controlled generative AI. That's why we call it neural rendering. And his big thing is, it's, according to NVIDIA, which I don't get because of the makeup that's being added, but they claim that it is only working on the lighting.
So
it's just a lighting agent engine thing. And it's like, how does a lighting engine add makeup and lipstick?
Absolute bullshit.
But that's, I think, a smokescreen, right? Like, we could fight with Jensen for ages about whether the technology is purely, like, lighting-based. But the fact that you are saying it's not generative AI, it's generating on the geometry level instead of the image level, it's like, no, but you're still fucking interfering with the thing the thing was designed for.
It's just at a different level.
Yeah, and it's like, and the fact that it creates like hyper real faces in game engines that don't have them is like, it's even worse. So I think they thought that they could get away with saying this is enhancing things, but where people want enhanced graphics is gaming engines where we don't have that level of detail. Mm-hmm. So like the big thing that they came back, clapped back with was, but everyone has control of this. If they choose, they can tweak it. But it's like, that's adding a whole shit ton of extra coding pressure on people who we know don't have the time.
Absolutely.
But like, on new games, that might be solvable. But on old games, where there will, by definition, because they don't have the polygons, they won't be able to, like, the engine is interpolating on rougher data. So there's no way that, like, you could hold the vision of the artist stable.
So I think this is the, it would be really interesting to understand what they mean by what was the term you just used? Content curated or content something of being a, okay, so is
it was content controlled.
Content control, thank you. So are they saying essentially that you could render a model without any features or anything on, put a bunch of reference files into the learning program, and then ask it to just make a character over the top? Not necessarily in that sort of way, but the content controlled idea. Is it, well, you can turn this on or off, or is it you can alter the way that this looks by adding and taking away things within the database that you are setting up that this is pulling from?
So I can tell you two things. One is this is on the developer side, so the developer has to add extra code to shape what this does. Otherwise,
right,
it'll do whatever it wants. So like, that part of what Jensen says seems disingenuous at best for old games. Again, he like ties it to ray tracing. Everyone said ray tracing was foobar. If we didn't have RTX today doing full scene path tracing, computer graphics wouldn't be what it is today. And it's like, but ray tracing is still in engine shit. It is designed and held set like your graphics cards render and are have very good competitive ways of making sure the plan of the game designers and engine happens uniformly across devices who are playing the game. This is not that, fuck you. But the other thing is, like what you were saying is, so he is, basically they're saying like, you could put code in your game to instruct DLSS 5 to be more aggressive or not. But what you, the thing you were saying was like, what if I just had a blank canvas? Could it like paint on it? I don't, it is not an engine thing. And like, you might like, because it's generative, there might be a situation. I think someone could mock up like a game engine that was flat that plugged into DLSS 5 to fill in those things. But you run it again, and it probably won't have the same.
It would be thing. Yeah, it's going to pull slightly differently. Yes, yes. Yeah.
And like, yeah. So I wanted to, like, geometry controlled and conditioned by the ground truth of the game is one of those things where, I'm sorry, I'm a philosopher and I worked in tech, etc. But like, ground truth of the game is doing so much heavy lifting and needs so much couching out to understand what you're saying. Yeah. And as soon as you start doing that, it's like, nope, fuck you. Because you know what the ground truth of the game is? This woman doesn't have lipstick on. She's going home from the office of a long day of work. And if you're saying it's conditioned by the ground truth of the game, what the fuck does conditioned mean? If it breaks the basic like visual descriptors of the person. Yep. And this is where the thing is I don't... The fundamental disconnect is if you are doing stuff generatively, even if it is just a light engine and somehow it adds lipstick, sure, I'm an idiot and I don't understand how that can happen. But like, you're adding generative stuff adds interpretation based on this element and then makes up a story. It predicts what people want to see. Mm. And that prediction is based on training data, etc. So there isn't a notion of your engine can be constrained by the ground truth of the game, but think of all the different aesthetic styles of games, right? There isn't a way of having a universal predictive engine that will get it right along the artistic designs and styles of the of every game. That's impossible. They have this notion that games, this is like one of the big problems of photorealism in games, is like, No, but like, people don't want that. They want artistic style and vision. And absolutely, if everyone was trying to make photorealistic stuff, you could probably get away with something like this at the geometry level. But like, that's not how it works, right? Like, but also the way these systems aren't nuanced enough to have the ability to say, oh, the reason why this object that looks like a blonde white female doesn't look like the average blonde white female in our training data because it doesn't have lipstick on, we should pay attention to that. Like, there's no reasoning. It's just always going to predict based on its training data, and its training data is going to give it a gestalt. And even if you make the training data vastly huger than it currently is, which, how do we do that? You're still going to have it predict towards the norm. But like, the whole point of this character isn't that she's not the blonde bombshell, right?
Yeah.
And so making her into that is missing the point. And nothing in the middle that is trying, that can only move towards the average prediction will ever get that right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I
don't disagree. But like, I find it interesting that the a lot of the examples that they have used for this are of games which were, at the time that they were released, as kind of graphically exceptional as they kind of could be. And going, you know, again, within the limitations of the games when they released, going for as much realism in terms of their graphical styles as they probably could. Like, there's no pixel art games. There's no slightly, painted aesthetic sort of games.
What are you
going
to do, add shiny lipstick to a pixel?
Exactly. It's all, like, as real as it possibly can be. And then going, well, you know that game that you thought was really, 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 really real when it came out? We've made it more real.
Oh, yeah. But, like, this is sort of the problem of the... I mean, this is actually an instantiation of the problem of the graphics card arms race on photorealism. Even though if you look at, like, the photorealistic high graphics, like, games, they all have an aesthetic that is different. If you look at, like, the lighting, even just the lighting, let alone the, like, models and facial structures of people in the new Resi game versus the last God of War, those will be different.
Yeah.
Like, substantially different, right? And it's like, it's just pretending that, like, we are all trying, like, everyone is trying to get to photorealism because that's what everyone wants out of games. Because that sells cards. Forgetting that, like, no one's trying to make perfect humans, whatever the fuck that means, if it's possible. Like, the most, even the games who are trying to be photorealistic have, like, base assumptions or aesthetic, like, choices that shape all of their characters if they want, like continuous aesthetic presence, for lack of a better term. And, like, yeah, based on that alone, this approach fucking dies.
Yeah,
that it doesn't work. But also, I kind of want to bring it up because, like, the disconnect was so apparent because it was like, you chose to render this, you got these renders, and you went out on a fucking press tour thinking people would eat this up. Look, we made it look like this person was wearing makeup and lipstick and they have more pores.
Yeah.
Obviously you would love that. It's like, but that character wasn't wearing lipstick and they wouldn't. Like, I really want everyone listening, like, think about how many people definitely had to look at these renders and think about it and make decisions on this going out to the public and how fucking completely disconnected they are from the basic tenets of, like, the art of video games. Well, like, this is, like, hilarious.
But that's not what this is about, right? Nvidia are so much more and are pushing. They are one of the foundational companies of the AI push. And this is, like, leading into that even more and embedding it even more. Because it's not for people who make games. It's not for people who play games. It is for stockholders.
Oh, no.
It's for shareholders, investors. It is is a tech push for them to say, look at us on the forefront of this technology. Oh. Invest in us, please.
But, like, this is what I mean about, like, not understanding things is, like, that works for generative AI. That's why all your video cards are going. That's why there's a fucking RAM shortage, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, this is them trying to use the same playbook on their old, like, standard fucking demographic and, like, clientele, and showing that they have no conception of what that clientele wants, et cetera. Like, that's why I wanted to bring it up, kind of. It was like, yeah, you're showing you can do things with thing, but those things suck, which is secretly what I think the entire fucking AI playbook is. It's just not everyone has realized. Yep. But, like, that there is a history with graphics, etc., and video games that has longevity that, like, AI doesn't. And so you can't just, like, say random shit and expect the consumers who have existed and thus know what they want out of the technology to just be like, yes, you said a thing. Thank you for saying a thing. And it feels like that's what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
And then for Jensen to come back and say, all of you critics are just wrong because technical, like, he literally said, they're just wrong. It's not a AI filter. It's at the geometry level. I'm like, when people say the output is bad and they mistakenly say what caused the output, sure, you can tell them you are mistaken on what caused the output, but you have to take in turn the output was still not wanted. Yep. Like, this is like insanity. And it's like, yeah, I get it, Jensen. You've got a $5 trillion company behind you and you think you can just tell the market what to do.
That's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah. But, like, I'm really glad that all of the reporting after his announcement was, I didn't see a single positive version of that, which is like, the fuck is this guy doing? Like, but also, I just want to highlight how disconnected these things, they are from what the real virtual world is what I want to say. It's like, hey, gamers want to live in the virtual world, and you're somehow disconnected from the virtual world because you thought that people wanted to paint lipstick on things. Like, the developers could have done that. Yeah, anyway, that's
absolutely. If those are my pieces. Chosen to do so. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Cool. Okay. I don't know. I mean, it's just an odd. It's an odd showcase. It was a weird fucking thing to come out with. But it is a look at us in the tech realm doing what we want to do. Fuck everyone else. That's ultimately how it reads to me. It's like, we're going to do this thing. You guys should implement this into your thing. Because we need to, again, embed what we are doing into your products.
Yeah.
So that we exist forever.
So the like cynical part of me is like, when was the last time Nvidia said anything really big about games? People have been talking about the AI bubble bursting more often in the past 3 months, and suddenly Nvidia is like, look at this thing that is our old thing.
Yep.
But they're so out of touch with what the old thing was, which I actually think is shocking. That's the most shocking part. It's like, how is, like, the basic idea of what people want out of graphics, etc., and, like, games completely been lost in NVIDIA of all companies? Because, like, this is so tone deaf.
Yeah.
Not only in the initial thing, which is, like, a huge thing, where it's like, well, no one who looked at these side-by-sides should have, like, not a single person should have said, gamers want to see this, because like your best case scenario is upscaling of like Morrowind or something, right? But all of your flagship examples are clearly not what the players who want to play that game would want, because it's like the distinct, you just look at the side by sides, I'm like, this is a different person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remind
right, like, that's all you need to do is be like, yep, this is a picture of a person who's down on their luck, blah, 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 blah. This is a person who might be going on a date that she's kind of excited about.
I don't know if you remember when Horizon Forbidden West came out. There were a couple of people were over on Twitter complaining about Aloy. And, you know, when we got close-up shots of her within the engine, within the Decima engine, and people going, oh my god, like look at her paws and all of this sort of shit, like, oh my god, she's got the tiniest little bit of hair on her face, like every human in existence. Yes, she does.
Yes.
And then there was those images that started coming out of where someone had, you know, photoshopped it or whatever, they'd run it through to give her a bit of lipstick and make her slightly slimmer, and to close the pores just that little bit. And I instantly, the amount of memes coming out saying DLSS5 on, DLSS5 off.
Yeah.
And that was like the one that kept coming up. And it was like, yeah, this is exactly what it is. This is exactly fucking what it is.
Yeah. This is, like, the often memes are exaggerating shit, but it's like, no, this is actually what you are saying.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I mean about the tone deafness. My favorite will always be the one I saw was it was like a from Sonic Mania, the like slightly remastered version of Sonic 2. Sonic, right? So like kind of pixely whatever. And then it was the Teeth Sonic original render from the first movie, and it was like, oh gee, DLSS5. And I was like, oh, you nailed it. That it's actually so insightful, right? Because that uncanny valley missing the artistic point making a thing that doesn't match the thing. All that's there. That's amazing. But also it's incredibly funny to see those two side by side with this label. It was so good. Yeah, I just, like, if you ever wanted to question corporations understanding their market and late-stage capitalism, this is actually a really good case study, because I am honestly boggled at how insane the differences were. And again, think about people approving this, people thinking about this, people working in a company that ostensibly was a graphics card company for up until a year and a half ago. Like, how many people have been shuffled around as naysayers, etc., because they would have said, no, this won't play well, bud, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how mm-hmm. what has happened in that company such that everyone who saw this was like, Europe, or was afraid of saying Europe, let alone the actual thing that underpins this. I'm just saying, even at the marketing PR level, this is insane for NVIDIA to have done. And then, of course, the CEO's like, yeah, you're wrong. It's like, oh, this is just, it's comically bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so that's why I thought it'd be a fun thing to talk about.
Corporations got to corporate.
What?
Yes, I know.
I want to hear more about Marathon.
Yeah, no, let's talk about Marathon, because again, a game which would absolutely just be destroyed in its artistic endeavors by having something like this turned on. You know, where are the references for this game apart from the game itself? So then we get into the...
Oh, anyway, I don't know if you know this, Ben, but Marathon's an established franchise, which you can download the first couple things for free on Steam.
Yes, you can. But then we get into the dead internet theory, and it just, everything feeds upon itself. We won't go there today. I will talk about Marathon. In that, I've continued playing it. It has continued to hold me, and it's a very fun and very tense experience. But I found myself, when not playing,
like a circus,
looking for Marathon on the things that I'm randomly, whether that's Blue Sky or Instagram and stuff. And they have recently, over the last couple of weeks, a player discovered that one of the stickers that you can put onto the guns to customize them was a QR code that took you to a website, which essentially was then the initial method to unlock the fourth map within Marathon. So for the last 2 weeks, there has been a massive ARG going
that people have just
delved into, and I have been
eating it up. In concept.
I've not participated, really. I've not kind of
That's got the best into part about it. ARGs. Assholes can do it on the internet, exactly. And then you can
find just followed the Reddit group that have been doing it, and one of the Discord groups has been really big in pushing it. And that's led me to, and I didn't realize this was the thing, Marathon has a set of people who on Twitch are commenting on other players playing. So there is a, and it's not a, not in like a competitive, it's not like sports casting. It's not a competitive sort of, commentator. It is almost someone explaining what the team are trying to do and commentating on it a little bit.
Sure. But like,
once this map had unlocked, and teams, you know, some of the primary, I guess, players of Marathon who are going to be, you know, now the rank mode is also unlocked, going to be really high up in that, who are trying everything in Marathon. They're the first people to go into the first, into the fourth map when it unlocked, and going through it, opening up the different areas within it and trying out and testing and experimenting within it. But there's this kind of group who just commentate on those people playing it, not them playing themselves and streaming and telling people what they're doing, but streaming, watching the other people and commentating on what they are doing.
So when you say commentating, do you mean like critiquing their playstyle, pointing out things they could have done?
Slightly.
But mostly just descriptive?
Mostly descriptive. mostly descriptive, and just there's two of them, and they just sort of talk back and forth about kind of what they're doing. Say, oh,
really weird.
He's gone to this panel because they've matched the code, you know, they've matched the symbols up from what they've just seen.
Oh,
and they kind of explain.
So they're actually like
what they're
FAQing.
Almost. And it's, we've got to this weird point.
The internet's weird.
It absolutely is. And I'm like, fuck, I just want to go and play Marathon. Like, I don't, you know, I can, I've got into the ARG.
Yeah, but Ben,
and what's been going on? This is like a level too far for me.
Yeah. Why would you play Marathon when you could watch people watch Marathon that will tell you what, if you were those original people?
Absolutely.
This is why you're doing the thing.
And I think it's almost the antithesis of what the, maybe not what the game is trying to do, but the nature of what an ARG is and what something like this is trying. It wants people to find things. It wants people to experiment. Yes, it wants people to discuss and then explore and find, but explore. But then a bunch of people want to explore.
Discovery is supposed to be individual.
Exactly. And people want to explore that themselves. And sure, of course, I don't have to watch any of these things. I can just turn it off and they have their audience. Absolutely fine.
Oh, but that's not how humans work, right?
It's not. But also, it's I just find it that, like, you know, and I probably said a similar thing about Twitch when it first got really big. Like, why are we watching people play the games when we can play the games? Sure. Massive industry. Now, and you know, things that I have partaken in, watching other people play a game when I'm working, and I have watched a few people streaming Marathon recently because I'm working. I wonder if there's people, what people in Marathon are doing on the third map, not even the fourth map. That's now just not the third map that I even haven't even gone into yet.
But that makes sense because you're doing, like, even if it's mostly in the background, you're doing a bit of information gathering and figuring out what you. How you could best do thing once you get to thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's like how a lot of this starts, but then there's also the contingent of like, this seems like an interesting game that I'm not sure I want to buy or play. I could just watch someone play it, which is fine, right? In the same way that, like, if you're entertained, that's what entertainment is. And like, I think that's the bit that, like, us as millennials had a harder time understanding, but the Zoomers who just grew up with a commentating internet had a better understanding of this is legitimate, and I've watched that. So like, my most watched thing on YouTube's or Twitch or whatever is probably people playing Magic the Gathering.
Sure, yeah.
In formats I might not even play, right? It's not prep, but also I like get to see people showing off interactions of cards and the rule set, etc., that of this game I really love. And so I get, like, and I will probably never build a deck that will, like, any individual, like, interaction, the odds of me building a deck once, let alone actually doing this interaction, is very low. But, like, it is, like, contributing my gestalt knowledge in the way that, like, actually, if I wanted to be very knowledgeable or good at this game and have all these ideas of get decks I could build, and I didn't have access to these things, I would have to play a shit ton of Magic and have a shit ton of, like, cards in my possession to try all these things out.
Yes.
And, like, that is a very functional reading of the thing that could just be entertainment, right? But I think we come to these things with this idea of a functional idea, forgetting that you could just want to watch a thing.
No, absolutely. It's more when you start to compare it to that level of I don't have this thing and I can see people using this thing. Cool, that's great. Same as when you watch actual sports. You know, these people are at the top of their game. If I want to watch professional level people playing a thing, here is the thing to do. Same with video games now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I actually think, for me, interestingly, because I think I realized this because I was doing work and just doing some drawing work on a project.
Yeah.
Drawing a bunch of lines in CAD. You know, pretty rote stuff, pretty easy. Put Twitch on in the background. And watching people play Outpost, the third map that I haven't played yet, I actually started to pick up a little bit on, and this led me down a big rabbit hole of thought, but actually pick up on the layout of the space. And I'll do this when we get a new job in from people. I, you know, I'm like, someone wants to build a massive extension on the side of their house. Can you show me estate agent at a minimum level plans of what your house looks like so I can understand what you're trying to achieve? Have that little bit of formal knowledge before I come and chat to you about what your house looks like, what you're trying to achieve, what the brief will be. And it's almost that little bit of understanding the spatial concept of the map to, so I'm not going in as blind as I would be going into it for the first time and going, no fucking idea where to go. Cool, I can bring the map up. That thing is here, that thing is here, that thing is here. Sure, let's see. But it's kind of, as you say, that little bit of information gathering, which I'm already doing as part of my job. But the rabbit hole it led me down was just because I've gone back to Battlefield. Battlefield's just released a new map. I'm like, I've got no idea where the fuck I'm going. No, not a clue where I'm going. Okay, let's just work through it and understand the spaces and understand the corridors and how things link and all of this sort of stuff. And it got me thinking about just how the sheer amount of 3D spaces that humans can just conjure up in their heads and just know from memory exactly how they work. This works for the spaces that you live in, the spaces that you work in. You have that experience. You understand after a few times of being there and moving through it how it works. And it's exactly the same for maps and spaces within video games and virtual spaces and things. But I'm like, how many virtual spaces am I holding in my brain just to know how to move into it? Like, could I play and jump exactly the timings from the first, you know, from Green Hill Zone, from the first Sonic game? Maybe not anymore. Probably. But at some point, you know, that might have started to erode a little bit because I haven't done it for 30 years.
Oh, so you've now inspired me to be like, I should really boot up a ROM and get something that's at least close to the facsimile of the OG NES controller. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure it's been 200 episodes at least since I've mentioned that, like, I had this bet in high school with a buddy of mine that I couldn't beat Mario on
I remember. Warp Zones.
Yeah. I know you know, but, like, there are listeners probably. And like, I just... Again, there's no way anyone could have possibly figured out that I was ADHD and probably more neurospicy, because in the 12th grade, I just did this. I grinded Mario in the students' union room at high school, and then went home in our family's computer room and grinded out Mario until I fucking did this once. Obviously, just once. Yep. But, like, those early worlds were so mapped out in my head, ingrained. And I haven't really, right, like, because they had to be, right? The hard part was you have to get, like, this was on a Nintendo in the fucking high school and a Nintendo in my home. So there was no save states. It wasn't like I could do what people normally do now, which is the norm, which is you've mastered worlds 1, 2, 3. Okay, so you just start in world 4. Yeah. So, like, boy, was my muscle memory actually pitch perfect in those first three worlds, because in order to do the rest, right, like, you just have to. But obviously, I had less repetitions in those later worlds because I had to get to them. And if, like, my muscle memory fucked up in world one, I did world one again. So I did another repetition, right? Like, it's but just
it's,
like...
And it's interesting that when we were... You know, in our formative years, let's say, in brain development, and we're playing games within 2D and 3D spaces and understanding spaces, we are constantly being hit like, oh, we've got to play level one again. We've got to play level one again. We've got to play level two again. We've got to move through. No, right, we're back again. We're going through it again. We're going through it again. That the understanding of space is constantly being reinforced to us as we're playing through these games. And I wonder now how, with save states...
Yeah. I was gonna say, but, like, we're so old, we started games that didn't have save states. Even not immediate save states, like, save scumming was, like, a thing that brought controversy in our youth.
Yes, yes.
Right? Like, and now it's just like, I think a lot of people would be like, what the fuck do you mean by save scumming?
Yeah, just the thing you do.
It's like, games have catered to, and this is not me old man shaking fist at clouds, to be clear. cater to people like having lives,
Yeah.
right? Like, it's like,
Yes.
no, you can save whatever the fuck you want in a lot of games, and that's a good thing. And like that's, but like, actually, if you look at the pendulum, like that's actually what makes the like the Dark Souls, Elden Ring difficulty, blah blah blah, is the active pendulum swinging the other direction. It's because save games could happen almost whenever you wanted, and it was like, oh well, there's a level of difficulty if you couldn't do that, or if you did that, then there was a penalty. What's the penalty? Everyone regrows, right? All the mobs come back. And that's like that the notion of the bonfires doesn't make sense until you see the like evolution until you understand the evolution of save states, right? Because like in the best you could get was like on a NAS was fucking a code you could put in that would give you the generic start stats but in world 8 or whatever, right? Like that's what could be coded in, and then you could have, and then you get to the point where it's like, oh yeah, no, we can just like have save states whenever because RAM was cheap, let alone the fact that like you can now have oh yeah, RAM was cheap, boy, all those like 8 megs, to get a whole save state. Can you
No,
imagine,
no.
right? But like it's this like constant continuum, and I like that idea, but like at the same time it's like, yeah, I don't think our brains and our attunement to navigating a level are the same as like a 21-year-old's, because the repetition doesn't have to be there. And this isn't a critique or we're better than them, definitely not, right?
Not
Like
at all.
it's just like, oh, the like the nature of gaming was such that we had to endure a thing, and thus that's what happened in our brains. And I think for the most part, that was probably not the best use of our neurons.
Well, unless you go into some kind of design of spaces career, potentially,
Right.
and being able to understand how spaces work and flow and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I'm gonna suggest that the title of the episode is not the best use of our neurons, if only because Jensen had said this neural fucking notion on the other thing. But anyway, there isn't the right answer, and we just live in the world we live in, and that's why you've managed to figure out how to make your memorization of spaces
Useful,
virtual and
yes,
non useful. Yeah.
absolutely.
I don't have that excuse.
Lots of other excuses, though,
That's
so
just lost neurons. It's fine.
they're gone, they're gone. Good, let's finish there, let's finish there
Yeah.
for the evening. We were the AI after all. No, wait, that doesn't quite work. Let's talk about the beers that we have drank this
What
evening.
we need to do is start talking about AI, man. Natural intelligence. Why don't people say that more? Sorry, that's like a new character I've apparently fucking workshopping.
Bring it back next week. We'll do another bit. We'll do another bit.
I've started planning for the Durham Free Fringe, and I'm like,
Yes.
oh shit, I'm clocked for another an
We could
hour
do some
show
character
this year.
pieces.
Oh, but no, yeah. So it's like I've clocked for an hour show, but also not that stuff. But I can't put use sets or bits that I'm putting in the hour show can't go into the like
Right.
comparing 10-minute sets. But yeah, I kind of like the like essentially what's his name? I can't remember the actor's name now for the life of me. He was in the Fast Times at Ridgemont High. The best thing about high school girls is I get older, they stay the same age. Blonde actor, and he just like often plays, he's like, yeah, but man, dude, like slightly stonery, revelatory things. And I'm just like, that's what the NI guy is like. Why do we talk all about artificial intelligence, man? What about natural intelligence? And then before he can start crediting humans, he's just like, have you heard about crows? Corvids, man. Can you, the puzzles they can solve? Like, sorry.
It just goes off. This is my ADHD brain
getting caught on a thing and flying.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Beers. Yeah. Brass Castle.
The Bacchini was good. I think my worries with the vanilla, my supposition that the worries would go away was well-founded.
Good.
My biggest complaint, again, I think it's good beer, but my biggest complaint is as the vanilla faded into my palate, such that it wasn't like masking things, the like interesting porter notes kind of also faded. So it just became a bit more of a generic dark beer. But I'll be honest, I think that's preferable to the vanilla overshadowing things.
Sure. Yeah.
Those first sips were like, oh, there's something interesting here, and I feel like you're taking it away. And by the end, I'm like, this is a drinkable beer. My ideal, obviously, would have been the vanilla fades into the background, but the like slightly more, again, like burnt sort of portery notes remained. Mm. But that was probably never going to happen just based on like how the beer presented. And it's not like there isn't a taste outside of that. Mm-hmm. But like that's like, I want more of the porter to shine through, but I'm really glad that in the like after a third of the beer, the vanilla wasn't overshadowing. It's just that the thing I wanted and the thing that was in its way kind of faded in the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a little more generic, but still quite tasty.
Nice. Good. I think the Kaleidoscope twist for me stayed the same. Throughout, you know, it presented the same.
Unsurprising with
yeah, that. Absolutely. Consistent all the way through. Even now, I've still got, having not probably sipped it for about 15, 20 minutes, still got that little bit of limey sort of zest just sat here still. This is a lovely beer. It's a perfect afternoon in the sun beer. And I would definitely be seeking it out, seeing if they've got it on tap anywhere. As well, so it's very, very nice, and I will absolutely drink it again. If you guys out there in the virtual / real world have been drinking anything or playing anything, let us know. Out of Lives over on Blue Sky, go to outoflives.net. You can see the video version of the podcast, look at the beers that we've been drinking, and watch our beautiful faces as we lament the state of the universe currently, or wherever the other places that we inhabit, YouTube, Out of Lights Net, all of those lovely video
Insta,
things.
Insta, Bisky.
Yeah. I'm at Nova47 on Blue Sky. Adilis.
At the Omniarch.
And Lucy, who will hopefully feel better next week, is JuicyLuce9. Follow us. Chat to us, tell us about beers, tell us about games, talk to us about AI. If you're really strongly, you know, opinionated about these things, come and have a chat. We'll shout you down. It's fine. But for this week, we've been tanked up. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Ciao. www.outoflives.net